Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts, as a commonwealth, is passionate about education. That's taken a number of forms over the years. Pretty heated debate over a ballot question on charter school caps in 2016 being the most recent example. My next guest argues in her latest book that the education reform movement of the last 20 years, ones that I would argue she characterizes as being of privatization, charter schools, and a disproportionate focus on standardized testing, has been a failure, and it's time to reinvest in public education. Here with me in Studio 3 is Diane Ravitch. She's a longtime education policy activist, research professor at New York University, and author of the new book, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Diane, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Also, to help us through and process Ravitch's arguments, we're joined by Jack Schneider, education professor at UMass Lowell and an historian of education policy. He's also co-host of the education policy-based podcast, Have You Heard? Jack, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to invite you to the table. Join the conversation. Where are we on education in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? What do you love? What needs to be changed? If you're a teacher, we really want to hear from you. You may still be at school, but hopefully classes are done and you can call in. Has your experience in the classroom changed in the last several years? And if so, for better or for worse, what's working? What's not? Call us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. Diane, I'm just going to start by asking you, why'd you write the book?
Well, I wrote the book because I had decided not to write any more books because I've written a lot of them. I too, am a historian of education. And I felt that I had made my arguments enough about the dangers of privatization. But then the West Virginia teacher strike started, and it turned into a movement that rolled across the country from West Virginia to Oklahoma to Arizona to Colorado,
yes.
2018. And the teacher strikes, I think, are not over yet. We'll see more of them. And I began to think, you know, it's not just the teacher strikes, but there have been so many incredible instances of people who had no money standing up to literally to billionaires like the Waltons and Bill Gates and Betsy DeVos. And I have a whole chapter with a list of dozens of billionaires who've decided that public education has to be privatized. So I gathered together the stories of resistance and showed that one person can make a difference. A group of people, a dozen people can make a difference, and they didn't have any money, but they won.
So, Diane, it only makes sense for me to ask you. You were the Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. You were a vocal supporter of privatization. What was the appeal? Obviously, you're not now, but what was the appeal to you then? Why did you originally support it?
I was Assistant Secretary under the first President Bush, and it was 91 to 93. And at that time, the idea of charters was a brand new idea. Vouchers was not even discussed then or barely discussed. But the idea of charters was, well, we'll have private people taking over public schools, and they'll surely do better because the private sector usually does better than the public
sector. And you found that compelling at the time?
I thought, you know, we've never tried this. Let's try it. And we tried it. And it failed. It's failed miserably across the country.
Jack, you're nodding.
Yeah, I'm remembering how these policy debates unfolded, where originally the argument for charter schools was that they would be a kind of experiment. The argument was not that we would replace America's public schools with charter schools. That's something that evolved as the neoliberal argument for market-based education evolved. But originally, there was actually buy-in from folks like Albert Shanker, the union leader, and from a lot of teachers who saw this as an opportunity to engage in experimentation, often led by teachers themselves. And I'm laughing because, you know, that really isn't what we've seen. There certainly are cases of schools where that has been the case. But what we've really seen is a more corporate approach to governance being the sort of more successful approach to charter governance. And there's a future that that this has opened up for us.
Okay, so I do want to be clear. You know, the Commonwealth has litigated the charter school question extensively. We've litigated it extensively here on this show before. You, Diane, have a whole chapter on the 2016 ballot initiative in the book. I will say that it doesn't seem like the conversation is over yet, but I don't want to spend too much time on charter schools because there are some other things in the book that feel less litigated and less talked about that I want to bring forward. Before I do that, calls are filling up fast. So why don't we grab a couple callers, listen to what's on their mind, and then we'll go from there. We've got Muhammad from Worcester. Muhammad, go ahead.
Hi, how are we doing? First of all, I want to say I'm a parent. I'm a Democratic supporter. I'm a public school person. I graduated from school in public school. But I'll say this. Since I graduated high school, which is 20-somewhat years ago, and now a parent, the public schools have asked for money, and they've failed to deliver. And I'll tell you this. The people that benefited from the money is administration for the most part. The bottom line, that kids are going through the system that is not being fixed. People are just ticking around the edges. And I believe our kids need a better education. And I want to say this about Trump, and I hate Trump. Trump has put this whole thing front and center for Democratic leaders and educators, because they need to address failing schools. And if they're failing, parents need to have an option.
Okay, I'm going to pick it up from there, Muhammad. Several important points there that we will get to. I want to add one other caller voice, and then we'll talk about this. We've got Bill from Draycott on the line. Bill, go ahead.
Hello, I'm a veteran public school teacher. I just wanted to throw in that I hear a lot of talk about money. The previous caller mentioned sometimes a perception that teachers are overpaid. But what's eating that all up, of course, are things like special ed costs and health insurance costs. And we're going to have to spend some money. I see an inability to hire new teachers, and my district is not easy to hire new teachers. And then we do everything possible to discourage them from staying in the field, like giving them a minimal starting salary and loading them down with graduate school,
right,
a lack of supplies and support.
Let's,
I'm done.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. So I do want to build, as Bill pointed out, he and Muhammad, one of the things that was common in their calls was this question of money. Diane, what is the right conversation to be having right now about money and school funding?
I think the important thing to recognize is that we are underinvesting in education. And if you look at the data nationwide, as I did, about half the states today are spending less on schools than they were 10 years ago. So in 2008, Massachusetts just passed a new funding bill,
very much needed.
It's expensive to educate children. It's expensive to educate children with disabilities. It's expensive to pay teachers a salary that they deserve. And we have not been investing in education. So I think we need much more money in education.
Jack, you're nodding.
I'm nodding because if you adjust for real dollars and if you take into account the fact that every human service-based field has increased in cost over the years, the cost of dentistry has increased over the years, these are not good arguments for disinvesting in public education. There are plenty of ways that we can explain the rising cost. And as Diane just argued, there are actually lots of compelling reasons for investing further in public education. One of the reasons why the cost has gone up over the decades and across the century has been that we are more fairly serving historically marginalized groups. Diane mentioned special education students, but let's also talk about low-income students, African-American students, Latinx students, non-English speaking students. These are students who cost more to educate because we have not spent what we need to as a society to ensure equal opportunity for
them. I'm going to turn to you on this, Diane. As I do, I want to channel Muhammad again, the caller from Worcester, who was arguing that from his perspective, we have put money into schools and that money has been poorly used and has largely been absorbed in administration. So I want to bring his voice back in because I think he's probably yelling at the radio right now saying, but I said, and I just want to bring that back. You go ahead, Diane.
I think that the larger context is to look at the lives of children in America today. And that is that about half the children in the United States qualify for either a free or reduced lunch. And despite all of the claims about us having a fantastic economy, half the children in this country are poor by federal standards. About 20% of the kids in this country are living in deep poverty. So you have to look not just at what happens in the classroom or whether administrators are paid too much or too little, but why don't children have health care? Why isn't there a clinic that's available to families? Why isn't there adequate nutrition for all new children? It really is about having children arrive at school ready to learn.
So, Diane, I'm not sure that a 50% child poverty rate is the right number. And I'm wondering if maybe one of our producers can check that for us. But I want to pick up on the second part of what you were saying. We had Mayor Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, here on Monday. We do a regular check-in with him, and we talked deeply about education. And one of the things that we talked about was the systemic level of challenge of students who are young kids and young people who are coming into schools with complex issues that are bigger than what we have historically expected a teacher in a classroom to address. Would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. I mean, we do have a crisis of mental health issues. There are many children who come to school having been traumatized by violence and just by living in poverty and having really terrible home lives. So all of these things matter. The classroom of today is not like the classroom that I went to many years ago in Houston, Texas, where the kids arrived in school and they had had breakfast and they could count on having dinner and having a home to go to. There are a lot of homeless children, and there is a level of stress and trauma that teachers simply don't know how to deal with.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Lisa, pull up a chair. You're from Brookline. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just first want to say I'm really excited that Diane is going to be speaking tonight in Cambridge at First Parish Church at 7 p.m.
Are you going to be there, Lisa?
I'm going to be there, yep. And I wanted to ask Diane and Jack their thoughts on we've heard that the State Board of Ed is considering intervening in the Boston public schools. And I want to hear their thoughts on whether they think that's going to be helpful or harmful, or what's the track record of states intervening in public school districts that are supposedly underperforming based on standardized test results.
Thanks, Lisa. And I'm just going to give a little bit of context there. Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, we're expecting a report in the next couple of weeks. The mayor and I talked about this on Monday. And one of the questions is whether their findings will cause the state to choose to intervene in specific Boston public schools. Jack, why don't you take it first?
Sure. I think that the state and anybody who is trying to determine the effectiveness of the schools needs to look beyond standardized test scores. This, of course, will come as no surprise. I am the author of a book called Beyond Test Scores. But for those who don't carefully track this argument, it's important to know that proficiency rates on machine-scored standardized tests track very closely with student demography. And what that means is that standardized test scores often tell us more about students' out-of-school background experiences than they do about the performance of the schools. It should come as no surprise, then, that a district like Boston, which serves a lot of low-income children, a lot of historically marginalized racial groups, a lot of kids who come from non-English-speaking households, that a district like Boston will have lower standardized test scores, even if the schools are just as good. And anybody who has walked through the Boston public schools has likely encountered great teaching, caring adults, in many cases, pretty great facilities, although obviously there are some needed infrastructural improvements, and kids who are having a difference made in their lives.
So, Jack, I'm going to turn to Diane on this because you talk a lot about standardized testing, No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top. You're quite critical of that approach to measuring whether or not young people are learning what they need to learn.
Well, first, let me say that there is no record. And Lisa, the caller, asked if there's a track record for state takeovers. There is a track record. I don't know of any that has succeeded. I've heard claims of success, but I know of many, many state takeovers that have been utter failures. Detroit would be one. A state takeover in Tennessee was a disaster, and this has happened in state after state. As for standardized testing, the problem that people need to understand is that standardized tests are normed on a bell curve. And so when they talk about closing the achievement gap, they're talking about a bell curve that's designed never to close.
Right, because there's got to be two tails,
right,
one on each end.
The top half of the bell curve will be dominated by kids from affluent homes, and the bottom half of the bell curve will be dominated by kids with disabilities, kids who don't speak English, kids who are poor. And so it's designed always to have a bottom half. And no matter where you move that bell curve, it will always have a top half and a bottom
half. That is really very compelling. So just a couple things quickly. According to the latest census figures, 1 in 6 children live in poverty in the United States. That's 2018. We have a teacher on the line, and I'd like to hear from a teacher. So Bill's calling from Worcester. Bill, please go ahead.
Hi. So my thought was about, you know, how money's being spent and what's being taught. If I asked anybody on the air right now to solve a quadratic equation using the quadratic formula, no one would be able to do it. Why is it being taught? Why is money being spent on such skills?
Okay, great. Thank you, Bill. So we have 1 minute, 30 seconds left on the entire show. Diane, in response to Bill, are we teaching the right things in our classrooms?
I think we're testing the wrong things. We're testing children. And I've looked at eighth grade math tests. I could not pass an eighth grade math test today, although I took a lot of math in high school. So, yes, there are a lot. We have raised the level of rigor to almost to make children fail.
And Jack, in the last 20 seconds or so, what's the last big question we're not asking that we should be asking right now about education?
What are the costs that we have paid and that we will pay as a society in return for our narrow focus on standardized test scores in two subject areas? What are our kids being denied in terms of the processes of education that they will not be exposed to? And what are the kinds of outcomes that those kids will see given this laser-like focus on test scores?
I really appreciate you both coming in. That was Jack Schneider, professor and historian of education policy at UMass Lowell, and Diane Ravitch, research professor. Jack, thank you.
Thank you.
I jumped right in. Diane Ravitch, research professor at New York University and author of the new book, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. She'll be speaking, as you heard, at First Parish Unitarian Universalist Church in Cambridge tonight at 7. Diane, thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks to all the callers and listeners today. I am Tiziana Deering, and I invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.